The story of The Clash is the story of a band that changed everything. Now, their fascinating journey is a Spotify original podcast called Stay Free, The Story of The Clash. Produced with BBC Studios, Stay Free digs into the archives to unearth rare interviews of the legendary punk band. From their days in dingy London clubs to selling out some of the world's biggest stadiums and the legacy they left behind. This is The Clash in their words, and like you've never heard them before. Listen to Stay Free, The Story of The Clash. It's free, and it's only on Spotify.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your How Can You Struggle to Believe What You're Seeing Unfold Right Before Your Very Eyes of Music News and Criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. This is going to be another music-free week. As you might imagine, we are talking about Michael Jackson this week. Leaving Neverland, which is a two-part documentary, just aired on HBO. If you've seen it, you're familiar with the traumas that are contained therein. If you have not seen it, it tells the stories of two men, Wade Robson and James Safechuck, who say that they were victims of sexual abuse, extended sexual abuse, at the hands of Michael Jackson when they were children. The film is extremely difficult to watch. I definitely almost vomited on the first night. It was very, very bad. And it started a lot of conversation about maintenance of legacy, burdens of proof, all the things that we've been talking about for the last two or three years in the context of the Me Too movement, but refracted against a globally iconic figure that allegations had been made against previously, but which they had never somehow seemed to stick. So we're going to have a roundtable conversation today about the documentary and about some of the bigger picture issues that are brought up by the documentary, including Michael Jackson's estate and sort of how Michael Jackson fans are addressing these revelations of the documentary. So we've got Ben Cesario, music industry reporter in New York Times.
Hello.
Joe Coscarelli, pop music reporter in New York Times.
Hey, John.
And Aisha Harris, assistant television editor in New York Times.
Hello.
Ben and Joe have written, well, actually everyone at the table, save me, has written pieces in some way connected to the documentary. There was also
How did you dodge this? This is a separate, this is a separate conversation, actually, but I want to know.
I don't know. I'm not averse. Maybe by the time this comes out, I will have written something. It's not impossible. I certainly had a lot to say. Everyone at the table has written about the documentary. And there was also an Oprah Winfrey interview with the two men who were in Leaving Neverland that aired on Monday night following part two of the documentary. I want to start with one theme that came up a lot in the film, and I would like to hear what everybody's immediate sort of emotional responses were to the film. But a word that came up a bunch, especially in the first part of the documentary, was adventure. I feel like you heard both men talk about their time with Michael. And even the moms, because the documentary basically is like long form one-on-one interviews with the two men who say they were abused, but also their mothers are in the documentary as well. But the word adventure comes up a lot, and it was disorienting to hear them still talk about that time, which came with all these traumas, with a word that kind of connoted wonder and enthusiasm
and pleasure.
There were many unsettling micro moments throughout the 4 hours, but hearing that word kind of returned to again and again made me just outrageously uncomfortable. And I'm curious to hear what some of the trigger moments for you guys were. Wesley Morris, who are a critic at large, wrote a piece about it, and he identified the moment where Michael takes James Safechuck to buy essentially a wedding band, and they say it's for a woman, not for James. And that's Wesley's trigger moment, saying Michael knew it was wrong. I certainly was alarmed well before we got to the wedding band scene, but I'm curious to hear what registered really intensely for you watching this film.
For me, especially as like a self-described lifelong fan of his, the part, or really the theme of the movie that set me off and made me like really just kind of want to curl up in a ball and cry was the manipulation at play, and the what they say happened in terms of how it seemed obvious that he knew what he was doing was wrong.
Yeah.
I think even if you thought maybe he did do it long before this documentary came out, of course, part of the whole, like the whole part of his lore and myth is that he was a child trapped in a grown man's body, and there are ways in which people might rationalize, like, oh, well, even if he did do that, like, he didn't, he really didn't know better. Like, he was, he had arrested development, like, and that arrested development led him to not realize that what he was doing was wrong.
Right. He was functioning as a child.
Yeah. He was functioning as a child. But, like, this, their testimony very much puts that all to rest. I mean, one of the more glaring parts was, like, Wade's recounting of the underwear.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't even want to say it aloud, but, like, the word, you know, Michael literally, allegedly called him, went to see him just to say, like, you need to make sure you get rid of this underwear.
That might have evidence.
Of what we did together. Yeah, I think that might be the part that really hit me the most was that, like, he was not, he knew what he was doing. And that's the terrifying part for
right,
me.
Right, not a knife.
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to go back to what you were saying about the sense of adventure. I think one of the jarring things watching this film is that it seems as if everybody has agreed to sort of speak about how they felt in the moment. It's very present tense.
Yeah.
So, like, the first half hour or 40 minutes are the adventure, as you say. You know, Wade Robson was a child impersonator of Michael Jackson in Australia. He's plucked from a contest and gets to meet his hero. James Safechuck was, like, a 9 or a 10-year-old in a Pepsi commercial with Michael Jackson. And they talk about the wooing and, you know, the getting whisked away on crazy adventures, as you said, flights, you know, gifts, coming out at his concerts, the sort of, you know, what we come to consider grooming, I guess, in terms of child sexual abuse. And you hear them describing and their mothers describing and siblings as well, these moments at the time and how exciting they were for them. And it is jarring to hear them knowing what's going to come next.
Yeah.
It can be jarring to hear them talk about those things in a way where the wonder and the amazement and the spell sort of that he casts still feels fresh.
Yeah. And they really access those feel like that's, I think that was also shocking to me how unreluctantly they could access those.
And well, I don't even know
James
if they're
seemed reluctant.
Well, yeah.
Yes. The whole time.
Across
but,
all,
yeah.
I don't know if they're accessing them as much as they currently feel them. And I think that, you know, from what I've learned about abuse victims in this context and wider, like, I think that's kind of a common thing. You know, they both thought that they were in love with him. Mm-hmm. I think they, you know, they both say at different points. And I think they continue to be tortured by the fact that they didn't know what they were allegedly doing was wrong for so long. And, you know, there are all these feelings tied up in it, you know, all of their first and best and the entirety of their life experience and childhood was, you know, loomed over by this figure who was both the, you know, the greatest sort of fairy godmother you could imagine. And then also, you know, as they say, they've realized later, the sort of source of all of their pain and shame that came after. So it's an intense way to make a film and to tell the story and to sit through. And I think, you know, there are moments, even at the end, even when they're talking about having come to terms with everything that happened to them, where they still feel reverent of him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah, very hard to watch. Ben, what are you thinking?
Everything that you guys mentioned was also very powerful to me. And I remember one of the very first things that said, I think, by James Safechuck is, he's the most famous man in the world and he likes you. Just that, the power of the celebrity to draw them in. I was also very moved and disturbed by the effect on the families. Mm-hmm. They talk about, I think it's Safechuck's mother talking about when they're on tour, she's moved farther and farther away in the hotel so that she can't keep an eye on him. And then also the fact that the Robsons, the Australian family, they split up. The mother takes Wade and his sister to America and leaves another child and the husband behind. The husband kills himself many years later. Those things also implicate the parents about how they went along with it, about what their responsibilities should have been. But I think you're very conscious that it's only happening because of the situation that they've been put in. And they wouldn't be in the position of making these decisions for their family unless their children had been preyed upon this way.
And
right. So
they as well were preyed. I mean, the mothers, it seems, right. also were specifically preyed upon.
Though I don't think that the film really positions them as victims. To me, I thought the film holds the mothers to account secondarily only to Michael. I mean, I think, you know, the moment that the film ends on, if you remember, is them asking James, like, do you forgive your mom, basically? And he's like, I'm still working through it. Like, and, you know, there are quite a few moments throughout, especially the second 2 hours, the half that aired on Monday, and when the mothers say things that are still seem like they're in denial. You know, Aisha and I were talking about this right before. Wade's mom says she doesn't know the details
right.
of the sexual abuse because it might give her nightmares.
Well, and this came up in the Oprah thing, in the Oprah interview. I believe Wade says, the director says he screened the film for the family, and the mother explicitly said, like, I cannot watch those details. Like, you have to fast forward past those details.
Which is like quite a way to be when like you let you let your child sleep in a bed with this man for years, and you want to then shield yourself from that. I don't know. It was just I think that obviously you feel for the parents throughout the film, but I don't think they come across well at all.
No, but I do think there's this transition between the first of the two parts and the second of the two parts. Like, you do get the sense in the first of the two parts that Michael is actively grooming the child
and
in
parents.
A different way grooming the parents. You have the Safe Chuck story about, we go to Neverland and sneak him out and take him to our, you know, split level, and he'd like have sleepovers, and both mothers basically identify Michael as like another child of theirs.
And a boyfriend. At a certain point, you know, the mom says, one of the mothers says, when Michael called and basically was like, I'm not going to hang out with you guys anymore, the mom literally says, turns to her husband and says, we just got broken up with. Mm-hmm. Talking about themes like the power of celebrity. Also, you know, there is no other celebrity on the level of Michael Jackson, but these things carry over. And, you know, we've seen it with R. Kelly. We've seen it even with Ryan Adams, who's not an actual famous person. But I mean, you know what I mean?
Just enough.
you know what I mean? Like, and you know, he's giving them gifts, Cartier watches, down payment for your house.
No, he bought that house.
He bought the house. Yeah.
Sending faxes with pet names on them.
Yeah, I mean, and the intoxication of that stuff, that comes through in the film. But also, you see the parents even today sort of with stars in their eyes.
Yeah. You sense how ill-equipped everybody was. And now, I mean, look, in the 80s, the early 90s, Michael Jackson, I mean, it probably would have taken an incredibly strong backbone to find a way to push back against this kind of behavior. But you do really get the sense of how ill-equipped these parents were. And obviously, you can't accuse a 7-year-old of being ill-equipped, but certainly the families of knowing how to navigate situations like that. And you have someone like Michael, and again, all this is alleged, but like basically removing families from their normal routines. Oh, you're staying in a hotel? Actually, no, you're going to stay in Neverland. Like, oh, like there's no time here. Like, you can stay a week. You could stay a month. Let me denature everything about
you. And you get a few minutes of pushback. You get a few moments of pushback mm-hmm. where the mom, you know, the mom says first time he wants to sleep in a bed, you know, let him sleep in my room. She's like, no. And yeah. then he's like, I'm Michael Jackson. And she's like, okay. Basically. I mean, that's basically what happens. And
yeah,
then the second time when he tells Wade, I want you to come on tour with me, right? For a year, he
yeah.
says, like, take him out of school. And the mom is like, this is not happening. But, you know, he
literally says, I get what I want.
I get what I want.
Yeah. I mean, the other thread to pull with this is, like, it's not just about the allure of celebrity, but, like, he was also dangling the allure of, like, child stardom for their own kids.
Yeah.
James didn't seem as much into it, really. I think he even said at the beginning, early on, he's like, yeah, I wasn't even a Michael Jackson fan. My mom just, like, kind of put me in a commercial, and that's what happened. But, like, you could have an entire different conversation about, like, child stardom and why we really don't need child stars because it's so like that is how these things happen. It's like a breeding ground for this. And the way in which that it even got to the point where he was like coming back into their lives after not being in it and like saying like, take your kid out of school. I'm going to like, I'll teach him how to be the next Spielberg. He's not a filmmaker.
Right. like a literal child.
Yeah. It was just very disturbing to watch that.
And we're also, I feel like we're talking about worlds in which there are no safety nets built in. Like there's no human resources. There's no structure of authority. It's just an incredibly famous person with enough money to fundamentally like alter how gravity works around him. And people are unfortunately they are helpless. Maybe other people were encountered at some point and were offered similar trade-offs and did not take them. We don't know about those people. Maybe at some point we'll hear more about different situations. But what you see are people who just don't have the internal structures to find a way to push back or maybe don't want to push, like deep down, maybe don't want to push back. And I think this is where the part with the mothers really kind of becomes even tougher because on the one hand, they're doing the exact right thing. They are giving their child like every opportunity, quote unquote. That's what they believe that they're doing. Like
I think that's part of the seduction and the manipulation. And as much as the film does portray the mothers negatively, I still feel sympathy for them. And that, you know, the adventure that you mentioned before, like the Robson family is split apart and, you know, the mother takes two of her children to LA. One of them's, I think, 7 years old. Rate is 7 years old at the time. And it's this kind of a promise that if we can just attach ourselves to this magical person, we're going to be saved. You know, my son's going to be famous. Things are going to be great. And that can just sort of be dangled over them. And it becomes so tragic how it ends up for them.
One of the things I think Wesley mentioned in his piece, we're talking about erasing people out of culture. And it's like Michael Jackson is like basically pure DNA.
Yeah, it's elemental.
Right. So you can't erase that. And I felt so uncomfortable at the end of the second part where they're showing Wade doing some choreography. You know, just they showed there are several moments throughout the film showing him doing choreography at various points in his career. But there's one that's, I guess, pretty recent. And you're watching him and it's like he couldn't escape Michael Jackson if he tried. It is central to his actual work, to the thing that he loves. It's there, and that's not going to go away unless he goes and like becomes like a long distance trucker. You know, it's not going to change. And the sort of like ongoing horror of knowing that a person who abused you allegedly is also somehow central to your creative practice is horrific. I found that he didn't say anything about that, but it just screamed very loudly to me. It was really, really difficult. I want to talk briefly about something that comes up in the second part of the film, which is this doesn't come completely out of thin air. There are prior lawsuits, criminal charges against Michael Jackson. So in 1993, there is a civil suit, perhaps?
It's complicated.
There was a criminal investigation, and at the same time, the family of the boy at the center of this sued in a civil suit. And Michael Jackson paid a very large settlement. He paid, ultimately, it was over $20 million to the family and to the lawyers. And then the criminal investigation was dropped. It got pretty far. It got to a grand jury, but it was never prosecuted.
And in 2005, there are actual criminal charges.
Yes. He's charged with a whole bunch
with a different young boy.
Yes.
That boy was in the Martin Bashir documentary. He was seen a couple years prior to that. And I think actually the documentary was sort of what prompted this second round.
Yeah, so it was the same LA prosecutor, I believe, both times. Is that correct, Ben?
Santa Barbara,
excuse me. Spoken like a true Yankee. It's all LA to me.
Yeah, right.
but yeah, so the first time they ultimately do not indict him, then this 2003 Martin Bashir documentary comes out that includes Michael Jackson talking about sleeping in bed with children and explaining it as, you know, innocent sleepovers. And that, as far as I understand it, sort of once again piqued the interest of the district attorney, who then opened a much wider investigation into Michael Jackson, which resulted in these charges.
Which trial. Eventually,
and a trial. He was acquitted on all charges.
Right. And he comes out and he's dancing on the roof of his car and
doves are released.
Yes. Yeah. And one of the things that I had forgotten about, but was reminded about because it's included in Leaving Neverland, was Michael going to court in kind of increasingly disoriented costume, kind of
pajama pants,
pajamas,
which is very childlike in a way, at least. And that I remember when that case was happening, I was in like, I think I was in high school, like last year of high school, but like kids would go to school in pajama pants because like that's what you did. And I don't
what high school?
I as somebody who was in high school at the same time, I can confirm that.
Well,
these
yeah,
things
oh, yeah,
I was going, man.
I don't know if he was trying to convey, you know,
youthfulness
or what,
or just eccentricities.
Yeah, or just eccentricities.
I thought it felt like frailty.
Well, he did. He also looked increasingly frail as it was.
I mean, he was being held up on both sides. I mean, it felt like a performance,
right.
Number one, obviously. But I also, I mean, you see there's a lot of changes in Michael physically in the early 2000s in terms of how he looks. And so there is a sense of like him physically breaking down, and that kind of walk from the car to the courtroom every day being his. He's like, well, I can't perform on a stage. I can't perform in a studio, but I can do this performance.
But his performance at the time, I remember seeming more and more erratic. Mm-hmm. In court, he was spaced out. It was very commented on that he just looked absent and looked ill. And the pajamas, I do remember that, you know, there was kind of the question, is he putting us on here or is he losing his mind?
And that happened all the way back in 93 as well, because, all right, so he's on the Dangerous Tour, 92, 93, and that's when the first allegations surface. Mm-hmm. And then he cancels the tour because he says he's developed an addiction to painkillers from dealing with the stress of the earlier accusation. So that's when he starts giving public statements about these things and talking about sort of being broken down by them. And that was something that ran all the way up until his death. Like, if you read a lot about Michael Jackson, or especially to his fans, they draw a straight line between the 2005 trial and his 2009 death. So I think, you know, whether or not he was performing this breakdown or not,
right.
I think it took his life eventually.
Yes.
And it was
in some way.
And it is sort of detailed in the documentary of like Wade recalling, because Wade was one of the people who testified in the trial in his defense, in Michael's defense. But then he also talks about like visiting him with his kids and like noticing that he's like seeing him drink for the first time, mm-hmm. and that he would drink like an entire like bottle of wine and then go upstairs and pass out. So I don't think Michael Jackson was probably ever not performing in some way, but like I think there is a sort of a blurry line there between what was an affect and what was actually like happening.
And also, I think the nature of the performance changed. We were touching on this a little bit before we were recording, and I think we should pick up on it now. Like, you think about early Michael and late Michael, or, you know, post chart topping Michael being a different entity than pre chart topping Michael. And Ben, you had brought up an interesting point in regards to that. I think we should get more into that.
Margot Jefferson, formerly of the New York Times,
Just
wrote
Margot
about
Jefferson. Buy that book, read that book.
Yeah.
It's a slap.
She talks about this like Jekyll and Hyde kind of aspect of Michael Jackson, and that to some extent we all kind of bought into it, that there was the crazy Jackson and the lovable Jackson, and that, you know, these allegations didn't just pop up 2 years ago. They go back 25 years, and that we know it, and in some way we love the music so much, and we love the memory of young Michael Jackson, that I think, I can't speak for everybody, of course, but I think for myself, we kind of compartmentalize the disturbing side of Michael mm-hmm. Jackson. And after he died, there seemed to be just the beautiful Michael Jackson that survived, that he seemed sainted, and we kind of forgot about a lot of the really haunted, disturbing side of him. And I think that continued for a long time. And I think part of the reason that this film is so powerful is that it is a really shocking return and reminder about the very disturbing allegations that, you know, that have been made during his life that I feel like we just kind of never really thought about.
Right. I mean,
recently,
the ability, and this comes up in any number of circumstances. It certainly came up with regards to R. Kelly, the ability of the public or members of the public to basically hold two ideas about a person at the same time. And with someone like Michael Jackson, whose music was so totalizing for multiple generations, there was almost an acceptance of superstar, exuberant, makes me happy Michael Jackson, and also, well, Michael's maybe a little bit off. And people, I think, up until 2 or 3 years ago, across the spectrum, were like willing to hold those two things at the same time and not in opposition to each other. In essence, just accepting it as the course of events. What's happened in the last 2 or 3 years is those structures have been completely dismantled. But Michael, I think, is like the prime example, certainly in the from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, of a very, very, very famous, widely loved person who, if you could somehow filter that out, was not presenting super healthy to the world.
Which is exactly what James and Wade are talking about in the film, is that he was their fairy godfather. He was the man who loved them, but he was also the man who abused them. And they kind of hold these two irreconcilable ideas in their head, and we can see them even kind of struggling with it now.
I think that's why it was interesting coming into this documentary, thinking about how people would receive it, because I felt like as a culture, we've already done such a good job of separating Thriller Michael, the Jackson 5 Michael, from Wacko Jacko, the tabloid Michael. And he was literally a different person at that point. His skin color was different. His face was different. You know, his voice, his speaking voice had even, you know, gone further into the sort of childlike direction. Something that Wesley's piece pointed out is, you know, he basically, after the first allegations in the early 90s, he wasn't really a commercial force again. You know, he had one big hit, which was written by R. Kelly, which that's its own thing.
That video.
And you know, he had a few moments, a few pop cultural moments, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't the same guy. And I think it was easy to have the one bag of the great Michael, you know, the Thriller dance, the moonwalk, the Super Bowl performance, all the magical moments. And then you sort of have the other bag, and that's the bubbles, the monkey, you know, that's the
holding blanket,
Lisa Marie stuff, the blanket stuff. And then for whatever reason, probably because as a culture we weren't ready to carry this, we just stuck child molestation in that other bag of, oh, that's the wacky stuff. And similarly to R. Kelly, and Aisha, I know you've written about like the Dave Chappelle skits about R. Kelly. Like, it was easy to be like, oh, that's the wild and crazy stuff, but that's separate from the greatness.
The stuff we love.
Yeah. And it was, and for the sexual abuse just gets written off as another eccentricity, basically.
There's a reason that The Clash were known as the only band that mattered. Their music transforms punk into protest. It fights for those who can't fight for themselves. And it inspires all of us to join them and do it loud as hell. Now, their spirit lives on in a Spotify original podcast called Stay Free, The Story of The Clash. Hosted by hip-hop icon and Clash superfan Chuck D, Stay Free charts the band's rise and fall and why their music matters just as much in 2019 as it did in 1979. Listen to Stay Free, The Story of The Clash. It's free, and it's only on Spotify.
If I'm going to be totally honest here, I find myself in wrestling with this, like, trying to, again, compartmentalize and say, like, well, can I still listen to Jackson 5? Because, like, he couldn't have been doing anything then. Like, he was 9 or 10 years old. What about Thriller? Like, I don't really know, because it seems like, again, we only have two accusers on the record here, and then we have the other ones who are later period. I don't know if he did anything before he turned white. Like, for me, like, him turning white is like kind of the line that I've always kind of struggled with.
That's your before and after line?
Yeah, because well, in a way, because when I was a kid, I was born in 88, and so when I was a kid, when I was like sentient, he was already completely white. But like, I heard his music first, probably, and I think it took me a long time to like realize that they were the same person. Like, for a while, I thought they were two different people.
Interesting.
Like, actually two different people. I was like, I don't understand. Like, I'm watching Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, the video, but then this is what he looks like now. Like, I thought he was two different people. And I feel like I still carry a little bit of that now into adulthood, even though I know that's totally irrational, but, like, that's what it is. And I do think that a lot of people, like you, like both of you said, are really struggling with wrestling with, like, how much of the bad are we going to be willing to take with the good? Because, like Wesley wrote and like many people have said already, like, he's not going away. It's impossible.
But it's also, the question is, like, how much does it implicate you in a way morally? If you enjoy the flowers of evil, are you evil too? You know, it's kind of part of the idea, right? Like, if you watch the Roman Polanski film and you're like, whatever, you're like, yeah, okay, did some bad stuff. I think that's part of what you eventually have to wrestle with when you're thinking about this question of, is it okay to continue to listen to Michael Jackson in some way?
Well, I mean, this is something that came up a lot, obviously, vis-a-vis R. Kelly, who was a more recent hit maker than Michael Jackson was.
Not that much more recent, to be honest.
Well, like, right, 10 right. only.
I know, right. I know.
But yes.
just wanted to throw that in. Fair.
It's been a long time since R. Kelly made a hit.
I was thinking a lot about something that Dream Hampton, who directed
Surviving R. Kelly.
Yeah. Something she said on Twitter. She's talking about public death. And I think she was writing this before R. Kelly was indicted on new charges. So it was, that stuff was still an abstract possibility, if at all. But there is a way that communities and groups of people and individuals can make choices on their own to say, well, I no longer accept such and such. And I was thinking, it will be hard for me to listen to a Michael Jackson song now without specifically thinking of what I've watched over the last 3 days. That will be very hard. Yeah, I don't think it'll get easier. I don't know if public death is the right word for that. When I think about, to your question, Aisha, about, like, how do we embrace or let go of the things that are somehow a part of us that have been recontextualized, it's such an individual specific thing. Like, there isn't, like, in all the conversation around cancellation and cancel culture and da-da-da, like, that doesn't just happen from a decree on high and then it just happens. It has to happen in the hearts and minds of one individual at a time. And I feel like the way that it happens is, I hear a Michael Jackson song and I think of this, and I think whatever joy I'm getting out of this song on an aesthetic level is not worth the discomfort that I'm getting from knowing what I know.
But it's also going to be decided in, are his songs going to be played at weddings? Are they going to be played at prom?
Would you play it at, I mean, would you in this moment?
I was planning, I'm getting married in a, not soon, like in a year. But, like, I've always said I wanted, there will be Michael at my party, at my wedding.
And now,
probably not. But I can't say for sure that I'm never going to, like, I just found myself freaking humming a song the other day, like humming an MJ song. And then I caught myself and was like, what's happening? Because, like, that's just what I do. Like, I was a hardcore fan as a kid and, like, never kind of let that go. But, like, as far as, like, subjecting other people, like, I don't want it to trigger. Like, I was at the Oprah taping,
right,
that she did with the accusers. And it was a room full of mostly survivors, and having to be around that and take in, like, this sort of communal experience of these people who have experienced what Wade and James say they experience. Like, I wouldn't feel comfortable playing, like, blasting that music in, like, a public setting at this point. I can't.
Does that last, though? Like, what happens after the sting of an HBO premiere? Like,
right,
especially with something that is, as we've said, so, it's the formation of so much of the culture, popular culture that came after it, and musical culture. Mm-hmm. Like, do these things last? Is there a historical example of somebody being so bad in their moment that they got stamped out of history despite their impact? Like, we're just now tearing down Confederate monuments. Like, you know what I mean? Like, what happens to,
well, Bill
in
Cosby
25
hasn't
years
bounced back yet? I mean, that hasn't been as.
But
long.
There, sure, there are networks that are still playing the Cosby Show.
But what happens in 25 years when it's again just a legend that,
sure,
that Michael Jackson is a molester, and somebody, it's not It's not getting taken off Spotify as far as we know to for this moment. Someday, who knows if Spotify exists in 25, mm-hmm. 30, 50 years. But when some kid discovers Off the Wall, plays it through, goes on Wikipedia, and there's a section that says controversy.
Yeah.
I don't, like, does that last? Like, does that last? Like, cancellation well, does I not mean, seem forever.
Even Roman Point, like, last year was the 50th anniversary of Rosemary's Baby, and there were tons of, like, retrospectives on that movie.
And Rosemary's Baby will live forever, yeah. I think. I think it'll be taught in film school forever.
I did wonder, after Michael died, how we were going to remember him, and if we had remembered the problematic Michael in 2009, and if that became his identity for us, would we be thinking about him differently now? Would a generation grow up with different feelings about him? Would we not have the flash mobs and the songs at the proms and everything? There's a lot of elements that go into somebody's public reputation over the years in our culture. And I think that we remembered the good Michael. And so that helped kind of plant the seeds that we're still feeling now.
Right. And that this documentary is such a sort of disorienting right. jolt away from. You wrote a story about the Jackson estate and the potential implications of this moment in time and these revelations and these accusations, rather, and what they mean, what they could portend for the estate. Can you tell us a little bit about what people said? I know you talked to some people who had been close to his estate previously. Can you talk through what they were saying to you?
I mean, the general consensus seems to be that the film could affect the legacy of Michael Jackson and impact the business of the estate, that it's powerful enough that it comes with the platform of HBO. And I think that was even before Oprah was attached to it, that people told me this, that it needs to be taken seriously and that it needs to be taken seriously as the latest iteration of the Me Too process that we've seen, of how it's affected the legacy of other famous people. But I think it needs to be said that the Michael Jackson estate is a very, very lucrative and stable entity.
Can you talk about a couple of the things that were already in motion and what might sure. happen to those things?
There's a Cirque du Soleil show in Vegas. It's been very popular for, I don't even remember how
like
long
seven
now.
Years or
quite a long time. And next year, there's planning to be a Broadway jukebox musical called Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. Lynn Nottage is the playwright. And, you know, she's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. She's one of the most respected playwrights alive. She's a Black woman. Her work is politically charged in nature. And so right off the bat, there was a question of like, whoa, what's going to happen with this production? They canceled an out-of-town tryout.
And the show is also supposed to take place right. in 1992 yes. and 1993 when the first accusations surfaced, right? right?
Mm-hmm. So
it's based around the Dangerous Tour.
Yeah. So, you know, a Broadway show is going to be marketed to families and suburban audiences and wealthier people who can buy a $150 ticket. So there's those people are probably going to watch HBO. Will those people be turned off about Michael? Will they be willing to spend hundreds of dollars to go see that? There's a question about Lynn Nottage and how she will deal with this, mm-hmm. whether she recognizes that there could be a damage to her own reputation.
She no commented for your story, yeah. I believe.
Yeah, none of them commented.
That was the sort of most, in your piece, that was the part that I was most curious about. Because I don't see, number one, how Lynn Nottage stays on this. And number two, I feel like this is not going to happen.
Well, I think we should also say that it's important to note the estate is going pretty scorched earth against yes. this documentary. You could talk about this more, but they've filed a huge lawsuit against HBO. They've denied it from the moment the premiere at Sundance was announced in early January.
They've also really harshly criticized Robson and Safechuck and hit them very hard on their credibility as, right. quote, serial perjurers. And, I mean, that is a big issue for the film, is that the two stars of the film have previously denied it.
And it is also a film that is not about evidence that is acceptable in a criminal. You know, these are right. survivors' stories, which we take as truth. We accept it.
Now but, we do.
Yes, in this
some people
right,
do.
This,
some
yeah,
people,
sorry.
Yes.
In this moment, that is the standard has changed in this moment. But Joe, you wrote a story about people who are not accepting it.
Michael Jackson has maybe the most devoted fan army that you can think of. You know, obviously, we've talked a lot about this on podcasts, and the sort of moment of stans mm-hmm. is really buzzing mm-hmm. in the last few years. And people think of, no pun intended, people think of the Beehive, you know, people think of the Barbs, the One Directioners, Ariana has her people, the Rihanna Navy, sure. But Michael Jackson, like Michael Jackson, somebody who did not really make commercially viable music in the internet era, is perhaps the musician online if you know where to look, or if you summon him by perhaps tweeting something about Michael Jackson or writing an article. They came for Ava DuVernay. Yeah.
They came for Oprah.
They came for Oprah.
I mean,
like, and this is not about the documentary. This has been happening. And one of the things that Michael's fans are so devoted to parsing, they're obsessed with all rumors and innuendos about his life and trying to straighten those things out. As such, they were into ripping apart these abuse allegations from the beginning. You know, they all followed the 2005 trial. A lot of people that I talked to said they got into all of this because of the trial, and then again because of his death.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the folks that you spoke to and also some of the sites that you visited? Because I think...
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in this hole.
Unless that's right. Going to be painful for you.
No,
we tend to think of stan culture in contemporary, you know, it's like angry tweet storms.
Sure.
You say something that's against Nicki Minaj, and then for the next 24 hours...
They tell you you're ugly.
Right. And you have to like put your Twitter on private or mute people or block people or whatever. But that, there's like a little bit more like serial... Like
yeah,
serial
this is
podcast
way,
kind
yes,
of situation.
This is
here.
Way deeper. This is, you know, people, you can
true
see similarities to all kinds of truthers, flat earthers, 9/11 truthers, you know, JFK.
They're gonna come for you again.
JFK you just... conspiracy theorists. Look, I'm presenting both sides here. there are blogs, many blogs vindicating Michael, Vindicate Michael Jackson 2.0, MJIsInnocent.com. Very, very, very detailed stuff. These people are writing 10, 20,000 words about how Robeson and Safechuck's stories have changed over time, about all the things left out of the documentaries. These people who are doing this are young, they're old. I talked to someone in Huntsville, Alabama. I talked to a woman from Germany, someone in Russia.
You get so the sense that it's like their job.
Yes. And
these their
are,
ages are very, I sort of assume
ages
they were
are
all
varied.
Maybe in their 40s or 50s.
No.
Interesting.
People, you know, in their early 30s, people in their mid to late 60s. I've never seen anything like it.
Does it seem like they're mostly, though, concentrated, like, not in the U.S.? Just because, like.
It is very international, but there
is a lot in
the U.S.
There's
a lot in the U.S.
I remember, I think it was 2013, there was a trial in the AEG case. Michael's mother sued AEG, the concert company that employed the doctor who was convicted of manslaughter, and the case fell apart. They lost it. But I did go to the trial periodically, and every day, this is the courthouse in downtown LA, every day there'd be half a dozen people outside waiting to get into the courtroom.
Blogging every moment.
Blogging every minute. Like by the time I got back to my hotel room and pressed the space bar on my laptop, somebody had uploaded documents to Scribd.
There was a great LA Times article that you pointed me to that informed my story this week on these fans.
So
about
they've been
one of
like
these
they've been revved up for this.
Yeah.
For years.
So this is like their moment. You know what I mean? These are cases that they believe they know inside and out. You know, Wade Robson came forward in 2013, I think, with his claims and then lawsuit. They've been following since then. It didn't really rise to this sort of mainstream court of public opinion level until this HBO documentary. But, you know, these are people who a type of fandom that you saw when Michael was alive, right? The people crying, falling at his feet, picking up his trash, that kind of thing. But now it's all online and they believe not only that he's the greatest musician to have ever lived, but that he's the greatest person to have ever lived. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked to someone who said, even if none of the dance moves, music videos, songs existed, I would still be a Michael Jackson fan because of his humanitarian dedication. You know, he taught me about charity. He taught me what it was like to be a good person. Like these people will not hear a bad word about Michael Jackson. And And they're trying to tear these men apart. You know, they see them as people whose stories have changed,
enemies
who are after
state.
Money. Right. And yeah, I don't, it's very
to me, between the fans and the estate, though, there's a sense of desperation and kind of like a hyper reaction to it, that the estate's reaction, you said, scorched earth, very, very harsh. And it, I think it can be seen as a bit tone deaf to just the only thing you have to say about someone making an accusation of serious sexual abuse, child abuse, is you're a liar.
And I spoke to the director of the film, Dan Reed, about this, and he said, you know, he's paraphrasing, but he said, like, what kind of person do you have to be to hear 4 hours of somebody telling you that they were raped as a child, and all you want to say is, you're a liar, you know, like right off the bat. And then on the other hand, you know, I talked to a fan and an author about Michael who said, this is hard for me. I feel a huge sense of dread. I think that this could be the end of Michael Jackson. And basically, this is what I ended my story on. He compared it to therapy, that these fans are out there trying to do their part. And even if it doesn't work, they felt like they have to give this last gasp in his defense.
Of loyalty.
I mean, I do wonder, you know, with the R. Kelly, and really with a lot of these Me Too stories or Me Too related stories, like, after one person comes forward, usually there's more people who are coming forward. Mm-hmm. But, like, so far it's been radio silence. And I do wonder if, in part, the reason that is because the fans are the worst.
Right. And Wade and James said that to me specifically. They said, you know, this was in our minds when we came forward, and we think it's not only for Michael Jackson, but especially for Michael Jackson, that this could be a reason why more people don't come forward.
Can I pick up on something you just said about that sort of last gasp of loyalty from the fans? What I see in this film, especially in towards the end of the film and also in the Oprah interview, are almost these last gasps of loyalty from Wade and James to Michael. You have James on the Oprah interview, like, basically saying, like, I felt guilty about speaking publicly like yesterday. He's still processing. He's still dealing with it. And Wade seems maybe a little bit further down the path of kind of reconciling everything in his mind, but, like, still, very, you know, not far removed from wanting to protect, and both speaking about Michael as a person that they still have love for. And so it's interesting that the impulses of these fans who are speaking out against Wade and James are, in an odd way, not totally different than some of the impulses that Wade and James still have.
Well, as I think we've learned more as we come to understand better how abuse works, is that, you know, you're never really truly done processing. I think Wade said that at the taping, the Oprah taping I was at. But also that, like, that's part of, I think, what the movie does well is contextualizing how you can build this intimate bond with someone and not still feel for them. I mean, when you look at something like the abuse that Michael and his siblings apparently had at the hands of Joseph, like, he beat them. He inflicted very much physical and emotional abuse upon them. Like, Janet's talked about it. Michael's talked about it. LaToya alleged some things. And yet, like, when Joseph died, Janet was performing together again with, like, a big in tribute to him at her tour last year. I don't want to armchair psychologist this, but, like, it is very complicated. And I think that seeing Wade and James, hearing them say those things, like, still say, like, he was the greatest entertainer in the world, to me made it even more, like, compelling and convincing.
I do want to say something about the way the film is made, which leaves open a lot of these questions. And I think the reason that the estate and the fans have gone so hard at it is because it is told in a way that leaves out the other side entirely.
Like, entirely. It is purely, yes.
There are a few blanket denials from Michael within the film, from when he was alive, obviously. But this is not, to me, this is not journalism. This is two men's stories told in a moving, affecting way, but there are details left out, a lot of details that are relevant. There's almost no outside context.
Yeah.
There are no outside experts. There are no corroborating witnesses. There are no character witnesses. You know, they mention a housekeeper. They don't try and interview the housekeeper. Mm-hmm. They mention, you know, that Michael has this alarm system in his room that and imply that that's how he protected himself from getting caught. But you never hear more about it. You know, everything is sort of put out there in the telling of these men's first-person stories. And then the film moves on. And, you know, you get a little bit of Wade explaining why he testified on Michael's behalf in 2005 in the trial. He was the first witness called by the defense. You know, you get some of that. But you don't get, for instance, and these are things that the fans bring up, you know, as wild and the sort of intense and out of line as they may seem, like, you know, Wade Robson was in discussions to work on the Cirque du Soleil Michael Jackson show after his death. And he, I guess, was potentially removed from the project. There are things like this that are...
That he tried to sell a book.
That he tried like to that. Sell a book.
Things and also he was signed to Michael's record label as a young performer. Like, there are just other things...
It's complicated.
You sort of understand these men's relationship to Michael as this kind of golden moment of introduction and then kind of like a cloud of mentorship, iffy mentorship with sexual abuse. But certainly in Robeson's case, there's a lot more at play.
To me, this is a very interesting thing about this film is that it's so different from the kind of documentary filmmaking and the journalism that we've seen that has sort of defined the whole Me Too process,
right.
that's been established as a journalistic enterprise that's very thoroughly researched, that there's best practices of finding corroboration, of finding documentary evidence. The R. Kelly film, I thought the style of it was a bit overwrought, but it was a very thoroughly researched film that built upon decades of journalistic investigation that was filled with corroboration.
Many witnesses.
To me, it was pretty much impossible to walk away from that film and think he didn't do it. And this takes a totally different tack. And that is a bit of a weakness or a flaw that has allowed the estate and the fans to pounce on it. But I think it also is a deliberate decision that maybe there is no possibility of there being physical evidence, or, you know, if the whole idea is that these are boys that were separated from their families and that the abuse happened behind closed doors decades ago, perhaps there is no corroboration to be found. That's a really problematic thing. And I think for us that we're used to these things being thoroughly tested and investigated, it's hard to fully accept that. I mean, I thought the film was emotionally very, very powerful, but it was pushing my buttons with that style and what it was lacking.
And there are characters mentioned, specifically young boys who spent time around Michael, mm-hmm. who are and it's mentioned and some would say implied in the documentary, yep. that he acted similarly with them. And
it's more than implied. I mean, it's... Well,
yeah, yeah. And you know, there are Macaulay Culkin, somebody who has stuck by his contention and testimony that nothing happened. Corey Feldman has come out and said some stuff. Brett Barnes is another boy who's mentioned in the documentary, you know, who has maintained that nothing happened. Again, it doesn't mean that because Michael did molest one man that he...
Molest one
yeah,
person,
right, sure. But these are interesting cases, and these are people who we've heard some from in the past, we may hear more from in the future. And I think, you know, this Michael Jackson story, I don't think we've heard the last of it. And I think it's ripe for
a follow-up.
Yeah. I mean, something more along the lines of the OJ documentary, the eight-part, yeah. you know, ESPN OJ documentary from a few years ago that sort of takes in all the evidence, all the cultural context, you know, is this sort of sweeping portrait. This is not that. This is a very narrow story of two men's lives, which, you know, as we've said, is very moving and is believable. But it doesn't feel like the end of this line of questioning
also
regarding Michael Jackson.
One thing to sort of juxtapose the R. Kelly series with Leaving Neverland, we were asking the question before about, like, how long does this last, this moment, this kind of skepticism about Michael Jackson? Like, in 5 years, are people going to say, oh, that was a weird blip? You remember in 2019 when people were not listening to Michael Jackson? Because of the internet, because of social media, things get run through very quickly. And if there is a loud thing that happens next week or the week after, it may make this slightly less loud. Speaking of the two documentaries, I thought their different approaches to kind of dealing with the attention economy problem was pretty intriguing. Leaving Neverland is, like, incredibly calm. It's quiet. There's, like, soaring drone footage. It's
all drone shots of Neverland.
So much. You could cut out all of that and have an hour left.
The camera shots are just long, and they're just holding the shot. It's just people talking. Wade, especially, he's a famous person. Like, he holds the camera really effectively, and the camera just holds on him. And in forcing you to kind of come out of the hecticness of, like, everybody's tweeting about this all the time, like, you're forced to stare and absorb and be patient with it. And that, I thought, was, I don't want to say it's a shtick, but it was the gimmick that helped this be as effective as it is. The R. Kelly thing, I think, was the opposite. It got into the mess. It sort of dove in, and it was like, everything is complicated. 10 people are talking at once. All these different people are people are coming and arriving and leaving and showing and telling little bits here and little bits there. And that was its way of controlling. I mean, if you were on Twitter those nights that Surviving R. Kelly was there, it was felt like it was woven into the conversation. And this was as well, but in a very different way.
To that point, I think there are a few factors to consider when you compare the two, which is, you know, one is that unlike with Michael R. Kelly, there were so many different, there were like dozens maybe of women who came forward or who had come forward. You had some concrete evidence,
right,
such as him marrying Aaliyah, even though that was there 25 years ago and no one picked it up. But you had that. But then you also had the fact that I do wonder if part of the reason Dan Reed told his story in that way is because Michael is dead. And so I don't know what exactly the end goal is, but I don't think the end goal is necessarily the same as it was with R. Kelly.
Interesting. Yeah.
Like, we are now, and I think that might be why R. Kelly might be more effective, not just for status in terms of who was more famous, but also the fact that R. Kelly could still get what's supposed to be coming to him.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if the Michael Jackson estate dries up, I mean, to some extent, then, like, his kids are getting punished for that in a weird way. But, like, that's the estate. It's not Michael himself. Like,
he's beyond repercussions.
Yeah, there's only so much closure that Wade and James are going to get from this. And I hope it does give them some closure, but...
Yeah, I think, like, the tone of the R. Kelly film was kind of, R. Kelly must be stopped. He's doing this. He's a threat.
It's ongoing.
It's ongoing. He, like, needs to be stopped.
One of them was recent.
Right.
Like, yeah.
And with Michael Jackson, I feel like the feeling you get is these men have to be believed. It's like, that's what it wants us to think. That's the message that it's sending. And Michael is dead and he can't be held accountable. He can't go to jail. He's made his money, but it's kind of about the men, the victims.
Can I ask you a question, John?
Yeah.
Do you think it is possible for Michael Jackson's music to be canceled, to disappear, to be lost?
It sort of gets back to what I was saying before. Cancellation is not a dictate. It's a decision that a billion people have to make on their own. And a billion people are unlikely to all decide that. People will find rationalizations. Joe certainly talked to people who have no interest in that whatsoever. It'll be interesting to see how big corporations, your Spotify's, your iTunes, your Apple Music's, and so on and so forth, how they navigate the waters of Michael Jackson. You'd have to eliminate 20 years of pop music.
So it's going to be with us. It's going to stay with us. We're going to have to think about this. Like, we're going to hear Beat It coming out of a car driving down Atlantic Avenue. And so, like, we're going to have to think about it.
But that does seem like the new normal. I mean, this is, if I've learned anything in the last 2 to 3 years, it's that there is the normal state of consumption is no longer passive. It's no longer omnidirectional. It's contested. It's complicated. And if you're sitting and listening to the radio, you know, you used to think of radio as kind of like passive listening, but that's not an option anymore. Now, there's a constant parsing. There's a constant assessment. Am I being fed a thing that is healthy for me to be fed? Am I being fed a thing that someone is irresponsibly feeding to me? when I think about listening now, listening, not to get all Ben Ratliff about it, but like listening in 2019 is not what listening was in 2016 or 2015. And that is the new normal. So that's whatever happens with Michael Jackson is like a subset of what I think is a sea change in how we listen, how generations of people are choosing to listen or not. And I think certainly the critics, the music critics of 10 to 20 years from now are going to have a much different relationship with the act of listening than the critics of my generation or older generations. When I was listening, it wasn't a choice, but now it is perceived as a choice. That's our show. Thank you for bearing with us for this very tough conversation. Thank you to Ben, to Joe, and Aisha. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us if you want to talk more about this at podcast@nytimes.com. We're there and we're listening. And you can subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, and we will be back next week. Thank you.